Hello, and welcome to Back Issue Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayer.
In this episode, we'll be having a spoiler-filled discussion about an older comic book storyline.
In this Back Issue Spotlight, I'm joined by James, and we are going to have a discussion around Invincible issues 7 through 13. Now, fair warning, there will be some major spoilers in this discussion. James, how you doing tonight?
I'm actually doing pretty well, especially since we chatted a little bit before we started recording. You kind of perked me up because we both had stressful days.
Yeah, well, that happens once in a while.
Yeah.
Now, issues 7 and 8 of this are the back half of the second trade, 9 through 13 are the third trade, because we kind of, you know, did 6 issues, which is a trade and a half on the previous episode we did to this. I think these issues are really where things start happening in this series.
I would agree with you there. I felt like this is where it hooked me.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to say, you know, what's interesting about that is that's a good thing. It hooked me here. But it's also, you know, looking back, I'm like, man, that's kind of dangerous, because I remember we were like, oh, it's good, but it's just okay. And maybe if we're being a little, you know, more discerning with our pull list, you know, for the hooky by the 7th or 8th issue, that's not necessarily a good thing, you know, in today's market.
Well, this is a younger, earlier Robert Kirkman doing the writing, of course, because this was back in 2004-ish. And there are aspects of this where I think he's got some really good writing. There are other aspects where I think he's actually got some bad habits that I think he breaks later on, although it takes a while. And I mean, I've got mixed feelings on his writing chops at this point. Because I do think this series had very much a slow burn, to your point, if it takes 7 or 8 issues to really get to that, okay, I've got to start, you know, keep reading this kind of moment.
And yeah.
Even this 7th issue, it starts off, I'm not going to say bumpy, but boringly.
Oh, yeah, for sure. You know, like a you see him sleeping for 2 pages, which I was like, the same part over and over.
Exactly.
That's not a good way.
It's the same panel stacked 4 times on 2 consecutive pages.
Yeah, and then you get into that generic kind of like Batman fight, and not that that was bad, but it seemed like the characters didn't matter at that point, and it's just kind of like, okay, what's going on here, you know?
Well, yeah.
You start seeing like the Justice League, I guess.
Exactly the Justice League, or the Guardians of the Globe.
Yeah.
I think he wanted to originally call them the Global Guardians, but apparently his DC foo was not good enough to realize they had a team that was already called that.
Ah.
But yeah, this is the introduction to the Guardians of the Globe. We've got, you know, Midnight City is a stand-in for Gotham City. You know, Darkwing in place of Batman. Darkwing, isn't there a duck called that? Who's a Batman
ref? Exactly. Darkwing Duck. I remember him.
We've got Red Rush instead of Flash, War Woman instead of Wonder Woman, Aquarius instead of Aquaman, Martian Man instead of Martian Manhunter. Wow, just chop off the Hunter. That's creative. Green Ghost instead of Green Lantern, and Immortal, which you could argue is either a Superman riff, or I don't know, if you wanted to stretch it, you could say maybe like a Shazam type or whatever, but that was the one that I guess was furthest afield from the core Justice League, because, well, Omni-Man really is their Superman.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Omni-Man's the Superman, so, but he was another, I guess, to make it impactful, the story, that level of character, you know, really strong, you know, a Superman type character.
Well, how impactful was it when we've got our lead title character sleeping, literally sleeping through the issue? We introduce a handful of characters to kill them off.
Yeah, that was up until now. Like, I was looking at all these characters. I'm like, okay, this is a long chapter where we're introducing these new characters. We're really not seeing Mark, the main character.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get to the very end. I was like, oh, okay. And that was the hook that got me. I was like, I got to read the next issue.
Yeah, when I was reading it off the rack and stuff, that was the thing. It's like, okay, things are happening here. It was the last 3 pages were a complete and utter game changer.
Yep.
Because Mark's father just flat out kills the Justice League of this world.
Yeah, in the most brutal fashion possible.
Yeah.
It's pretty brutal, this comic.
There was some gore there. I do think, though, that in addition to the questionable move of the slow burn on this series, Because there are times where in the first six, it almost felt like they were just filling time to get to this point.
I would agree.
Not having introduced these seven characters of this, you know, makeshift Justice League or whatever in previous issues, it felt like this was all set up for that big, you know, reveal there at the end, and it didn't have quite the impact that if Mark had actually, I don't know, interacted with any of these people.
I agree with you there, because it felt, although it was impactful, because I know who the Justice League are, you know who the Justice League are, and I see what he was building up to, there wasn't that interaction with the main character, and they were thrown in there so quickly in one issue that if I didn't know who the Justice League, I'd just see, who are these throwaway characters, you know, why do I care about them? So there's nothing to really tie the fabric together to the main plot that we've been reading up until now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but seeing the dad at the end, I was like, okay, that's cool. I know who the Justice League is. I see what's going on here. Why in the heck did that happen? We got to read the next issue. And that's where you're just like, okay, I got to read this. And this was, I guess, essentially a story designed for people who are superhero fans already. You know, people who aren't you know, new to comics, I would guess.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, the whole thing is a riff on Superman and his son or whatever.
Exactly.
And there's a lot of visual Easter eggs towards some Marvel characters. Obviously, there's a lot of references to DC characters, particularly in this issue.
Yeah.
So I think he's trying to write something that is evocative of, you know, mainstream superhero universes. I just think that while I do believe this was his initial plan to do this, there's a nagging feeling that it could have also been just a Hail Mary at this point.
Yeah, possibly. And that's what I don't know. I don't know what's going through his mind, and I don't know how the comic was performing back then. Maybe it's that Hail Mary thing. Maybe that's what he was going with. But yeah, it was. I think that's that plot twist at the very end, it solidified the book for me,
mm-hmm.
and it made it something that I want to read, because up until now I was just like, hey, this is good, but Firepower is a little bit better. You know, this is early Kirkman. Maybe he just wasn't a great writer back then.
Certainly, I think he got better over time.
Yeah.
And I do think there's some stuff that he's done in this title over time that was really good, including some stuff here. But I think there's also a little heavy-handedness and awkwardness, maybe. It's hard to articulate exactly what I'm thinking here, because he's got some good stuff. There's some other stuff that is just so... It's like, okay, you're belaboring this point a little bit.
Yeah. Some of it's on the nose. And I think what it is he... for lack of a better term, he's not very eloquent in his writing. He's not a very refined writer. And so when he delivers things, sometimes it's on the nose. Boom, here mm-hmm. it is. And that, I think that's just a sign of, not that he was a bad writer, he's just an inexperienced writer. And now I think his segues to get into the story and get into the narrative and tie things in, he's a little more subtlety and he's a little bit more refined. He's a little bit... Well, he's become a better writer.
Oh, he's more experienced. Absolutely. I mean, the however many issues this ran for, I want to say like 144 or something, and the 193 of Walking Dead, plus all of his other titles and work and stuff, he's put in the time, he's put in the hours. He's much better now than when he was at this point in his career.
Oh, yeah, because this is literally 17 years ago, or 16 years ago. That's a long time.
Well, and he was... Early 20s at that point? Mid-20s? Yeah,
completely different dude.
So, younger.
Yeah.
So, not having the life experience that he has now and such. And again, he was still doing good here, because there was some stuff that sort of set this up, like in, I think it was third or fourth issue, when Omni-Man's like, get off my planet. You know, well, now we're starting to get a little bit of a sense of, well, you know, maybe he's a little more possessive of Earth than we might have thought.
Exactly, yeah. it's starting to come, you know, the chickens are coming to roost. And I like this. I feel like he was a little bit rushed, and he didn't set it up as good as he could have,
mm-hmm.
but he didn't do it poorly either. And I think that twist and that shock and awe just gets you excited to read more. So I like the excitement factor in there, and I think that's a cool thing, and it's completely different than the cliffhanger thing that you get from a Why the Last Man with a what's his name? I can't remember his name right now. The writer over there, but basically Brian K. Vaughan. It's very different. There's a cliffhanger there when you see the reveal of the father, but it's a different cliffhanger.
Mm-hmm.
very different writers.
Yeah, yeah. Now, what I find interesting is we have this major reveal of Omni-Man having, you know, killed off the Guardians of the Globe. And then the next issue is the funeral for them and, you know, tons of guest stars and such. But no real repercussions for Omni-Man, no realization yet for Mark, Invincible and such, of what's happened.
Yeah, none at all. Mark is completely in the dark. And so, I mean, you're literally seeing Mark and his love life. And by the way, when they were on the bed upstairs and the mom walks in,
mm-hmm.
that made me laugh because I had something almost happen like that to me where nothing was happening, but it looked like that. And I was like, no. So it just made me chuckle a little bit. Teenagers. But it, like you said, it was kind of weird because they're going about their daily life. You don't see any repercussions. You see, you know, cameos by Savage Dragon and some of the other Image characters that have been there over the years.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go and you're like, how is this going to play out? What's going to happen? You know, why am I not seeing the fallout?
Well, imagine if you had missed the previous issue.
Yeah, if you did, you'd be like, what's going on here? You just think this is a great guy and how'd they pass away?
Yeah, your introduction to the Guardians of the Globe could be their funeral.
Exactly.
Missing exactly how they died.
You're thinking of, oh, this is why they have to recruit new members. That's the whole plot. But that wasn't the plot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so you would be completely lost if you missed that last issue.
Well, I don't think lost, just very misdirected.
Misdirected. That's a better word.
Because I think you'd be able to follow. If you would skip number 7, you come in, it's like, oh, Guardians of the Globe. That sounds like a Justice League type team. Omni-Man's eulogizing them and stuff. Oh, what a tragedy and stuff. And, you know, you'd be able to pick up what's going on up until a few issues later when you realize what happened in the issue you missed. But I did find it a little funny that we had not one but two sets of grave robbers in this issue.
Yeah, I did too.
And the two guys in blue, do they get named in these
they
issues?
They don't. And I was wondering who in the heck they are at that point. I'm like, who are these people and why are they key to the story?
Yeah. This is one of the areas where I think Kirkman was not as experienced of a writer at this point. It takes numerous issues for, like, the detective we start the issue with for him to get named.
Yeah, so he's seeding this stuff, and he knows where he wants to go with it, but there's been nothing there that gives us a hint. I'm just seeing these random guys pop up, and a little bit just confusing for me at this point.
Well, I mean, they're, at this point, unnamed extras that are, you know, more focal character than that, yet he doesn't bother to give them a name, something we can use to, now, what'd you think about this character?
Yeah, even if they would have been, you know, Mo and Larry or something. But I have no clue who they are. I just know blue guys.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, one thing that also stood out to me, it's just from real life, you know, stuff that happens. Well, one, I thought it was funny when he's flying around with his friend and he's like, you know, he didn't enjoy that.
Mm-hmm.
But, the scene right before the grave robbing when the husband and wife are in bed and she's like, what are you doing over there? And, you know, and he's just chit-chatting. And she's like, you okay? He's like, I'm fine. Why do you ask? You just haven't been yourself lately. This is just, and she keeps going, you know, I know this is different, preoccupied, distant, can't put my finger out. And he's like, I'm fine. This is a very truthful and impactful. Like, okay, I've been married for 20 years. My wife can read me like a book. So if something's off with me, I don't need to say a word. If I was to hide anything from her, she would know within an hour or two. Just they get a gut feeling. You can just tell by mannerisms and things are off without them saying anything. So the mom's onto him at this point. She mm-hmm. knows something's up. And so that's like the ultimate seeding in there that she's suspicious at this point and she's going to get to the bottom of this. She's not going to let up. Women don't let up.
Well, and it begs the question of what she knew when.
Yes. And I don't know if it's a gut feeling. I don't know if it's just the way that he's carrying himself. But she knows this man very well. She's like, I've been with this guy for years. You know, you see how old their son is.
Mm-hmm.
Something is different just by the way he's maybe the voice, maybe the eye contact, maybe the body language. But she's onto him and her saying, okay, forget it. I said anything. that means she's not going to forget it, and she is going to find out what it is.
It's funny, because it's an almost very Lois Lane-like attribute of a character who's otherwise very much not Lois Lane.
Exactly. So that was like a kind of cool thing, and I was like, just by him writing that, I'm just my own life, I kind of related to it. I was like, ah, all right. Once the wife's onto you, you're not going to get away. She's going to find out one way or another.
Well, and again, there are some moments in these comics that are really well done like that.
Yes.
And then when you counterbalance that with characters that don't get named, some heavy-handed, oh, let's set these characters up so we can kill them, it's unbalanced, but a good enough read that it's not that big of a deal?
Yeah, I would agree. I agree with you completely. So I feel like I can see Kirkman growing as a writer almost from month to month, issue to issue. Mm-hmm. So you can see him progressively getting better to what we have today, where he's a very refined writer. He's just he's perfected his craft.
Well, one of the things I think he did better on Walking Dead, but definitely did over here a bit, is he had a pretty good idea of where the reader was mentally, emotionally in the story, and would really jerk us around in terms of, oh, you think I'm going that way? Well, smack, you're heading this way now.
Haha, yeah.
You know, and sometimes it's a little heavy-handed, like again with the seventh issue there. Other times, he's very much setting us up and playing fair, and then just kind of swerving a little.
Exactly.
You know, and I like that aspect, and that's something that I think he's got a good enough sense of where he's leading the reader that it's not the least bit accidental when he does some of this stuff. Now, whether it's always good decisions or not is another matter.
Exactly, yeah.
But I think he's... And it's something that I think within just a few years after this, he'd gotten really good at really early in his career.
Yeah, I would agree with you there. Now, one thing I wanted to ask you, seeing Ryan Ottley here and seeing Ryan Ottley, he does Amazing Spider-Man. I think he just off Amazing Spider-Man going to another Marvel title. Do you think he's progressed over time?
Absolutely. I don't think you could do as many issues as he has without progressing.
Yeah, it's kind of funny because I see Ryan Ottley's art today on Spider-Man, and I hate to say it's better, but I feel like he's become a better artist. Even though he's able to draw really quickly, I think he's just gotten a little more detailed with it. Mm-hmm. So he's quick, but the drawing's just gotten a little bit more, I don't know, just not as rushed as sometimes it looks here. Like I said, the art is not bad. I hate saying rush, but I think his line work, his aspects of when he's drawing things in Spider-Man today, it just like, wow, he's changed a lot over time for the better. And he was not a bad artist here, but I've seen him progress too.
I think there's some artists that you look at them early in their career, you look at them, you know, a few hundred issues later and such, and you can see sometimes a very visual, you know, difference in style. Either it's just more pronounced or it's crisper or it's more refined, more polished. Others, and I think Ottley falls more into this category, they're better, but it's not something that is immediately obvious visually, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, no, I know exactly what you mean.
I mean, his art style isn't, you know, a radical difference where if you were to look at some of this and then put, you know, one of his Amazing Spider-Man pages next to it, you wouldn't think, wow, these are totally different artists. Look at how much he's grown over that time or something. But you would see that one is more refined. It's just more subtly so.
More subtly so. And it's like weird things like I'm just looking at a panel, you know, just for the heck of it, where the mom and dad are sitting in a room and... Or the Mark and his father are sitting in the room, and the mom's walking down the stairs, and it just looks like the aspects off, you know, the mm-hmm. ratios and stuff. But he doesn't do that as much. It seems like when he's doing the 3D, it's a little bit more realistic, while at the same time being true to how his art style is. So I just think he's gotten a little bit better without changing who he is.
Yeah, yeah, I would agree.
Yeah, you can definitely tell who he is when you read Spider-Man.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, I also like how they've been building up the love story in here. You know, you see, I guess it's Amber, and then you see, what's her name? Who's the other girl that they use into?
Adam Eve.
Yeah, Adam. Yeah, so, like, you get to see the one that he's with, and then the one who has the superpowers, who likes him, but he doesn't know. But he should know.
Well, that's another thing. When she's... basically up there in the room in that one issue, and the mom walks in or whatever, she's basically saying what happened back at the Teen Team's headquarters.
Yeah.
From a few issues back.
Yep.
And it takes, again, a couple issues for some of the other shoe to fall or whatever. And it's like, okay, what is she reacting to? What did we see? Oh, yeah, that was like 2 months ago we read that or what have you, if you're reading it, you know, as it was getting released.
Yeah.
And that's something where I think Kirkman let a few things gestate or linger a little too long at times.
Yeah. And I don't know. I'm trying to look. If there was an editor on this, I don't think there was an editor, was there?
That is a great question.
I don't see an editor listed. You know, I see a cover and I see Robert Kirkman, Ryan Ottley, Bill Crabtree, created by. I don't think there was. There may have been, but I don't see him listed in the top, in the, you know, like the little
there
thing
may
at the
not
beginning.
Have been.
So without the editor, I think something that'd be cool, like, and he has the money to do this now. Back then, he probably didn't. Where the editor could have been like, you know, a little asterisk, you know, oh, as seen in issue number 4, you know, you know, little things like that. Which I'm not saying it messes up the story, but that makes it a little bit harder to follow if you jumped in here and you don't know what's going on. Just things like that.
Well, one of the many skills that Mark Waid has, in addition to being a really talented writer, is he's a pretty good editor and coach of other writers. And I think if you had somebody of that caliber, or somebody who's just been around the block, having read tons of comics or whatever, and basically pointed out, you know, by the time somebody reads this, it, you know, X number of weeks will have elapsed for them from when we saw, you know, her reaction shot to something we didn't see.
Maybe you should jog their memory or something.
Something.
Yeah.
Or, you know, you kill off these characters in issue 7. Yeah, you reference it in 8, but Mark doesn't really find out about it until, you know, down the line.
Yeah. That's where the editor comes in, and that helps a lot when you have an editor.
Yeah. Well, just a second set of eyes, because I think any creator, any writer, whatever, is going to be, they're going to know the story well enough that they may not always put all of it down on the page.
I agree. Yeah.
So that's something that I think he got it on the page, but I don't think he realized the lag of time on the reading aspect or appreciated that as much as I think he could have.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's something he'll build up over his career.
Mm-hmm.
And he did.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Now, did you like issue 9, how it started?
I was going to ask you the same thing, because it opens on a very clear Star Trek The Next Generation riff.
I know. I was reading that. I was like, man, John must love this. We got Star Trek in here, and he must obviously be a fan of Star Trek. So I thought it was kind of cool. At first, I was like, why am I getting this Star Trek stuff other than he's a fan? But then we see our old buddy there, you know, calling him amateurs, trying to help him out. That was kind of funny.
Yeah, but there was, I don't think, any payoff on that anywhere down the line that I recall.
None.
And it's, how many references does he got to toss in on all this stuff?
Yeah, at this point, it feels like he was just showing you what he's a fan of or something. You know, he's just throwing stuff in here. Because like you said, okay, you're a Star Trek fan, but this has no bearing, no impact, no nothing on the story other than the, hey, I'm cool and nerdy into this thing too.
Now, imagine if you know, we'd been doing this back when this was coming out, and I'd said, you know, hey, there's this title, Invincible, you really got to check out. It's got some stuff that's really happening. It's really good. And for whatever reason, you jumped on that issue.
Okay.
So I've told you it's basically, you know, a Superman and his son kind of a riff, you know? And you come in, and the first thing you get is literally a carbon copy repaint of Next Generation.
Yeah.
Wow, that's original. I've already told you it's a riff on Superman and his son type thing. You might quickly find out about the whole, oh, Justice League's dead sort of a thing. Are you not going to be thinking, wow, how original is this?
Yeah, kind of. And you know, when you say in the Superman riff thing, I'd see the Star Trek The Next Generation, then see the bald Cyclops in pink and be like, that's the Superman guy, I guess. Even though he's not. But, I mean, that comes out a little bit later.
And the funny thing is, there were a few other references in here that I thought were interesting. The Day of the Dead reference. I mean, 5 issues of Walking Dead had been released by the time this issue got released.
Yep.
So
yep,
kind
I
of a nice
that too.
Backdoor, hey, you might want to check this other title out. So not a blatant plug for it, but okay.
Yeah.
What I found really interesting was Donald, the government agent.
Yes.
He predates Phil Coulson in the Marvel Cinematic Universe by about 4 years.
Oh, okay. All right.
But I can definitely see some similarities there.
I can too. Now that you yeah, I see the similarity. So I did not know that predated it, but yeah, you're right, it does.
And then we also get the Lizard League in here, which is, it feels like a riff on Marvel's Serpent Society.
That's what I felt when I got there. So he's kind of like, you know, the Serpent Society, and they almost kind of look, some of the goons, like Hydra a little bit, mm-hmm. you know? Yeah, you see them all there.
Well, in an issue or two back, we got an unnamed villain who's in an elephant suit, which reminded me a bit of the Armadillo at Marvel.
Yep. Yeah, Armadillo. And you know who I was thinking of is, oh, who's the rhinoceros guy? I can't think of his name.
Oh, the
right
Rhino.
Now.
Yeah, yeah.
The Rhino. I was thinking of the Rhino.
Actually, that's probably the better one. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but yeah, there's a lot of like little riffs and little clues into this character, that character. And, I don't know. I think he's just saying, I'm fans of all this stuff, Marvel, DC, Star Trek, and it's my book and I'm going to throw stuff in there.
Yeah.
That's literally what he's doing.
And that's cool. But there's a fine line between kind of acknowledging the stuff that's already out there and doing it so much, it becomes a little distracting?
It can be distracting, because I was sitting here reading this and going, okay, I know this goes for like 130 issues. I hope I don't have to know who all of these people are, because that's a lot. And, I mean, not that I would get overwhelmed, but it can be overwhelming when you get too many characters into the book.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I'm like, let's focus on maybe this group and a few little side characters. I don't need Team Star Trek, the Serpent Society, and everyone else, you know?
Well, and it's hard to know which of these characters are going to be relevant, which ones may have a minor payoff, you know, 4 or 5 issues down the line, and which ones are just throwaway characters.
Because we have no clue. So we're having to assume right now that they all matter. And so I was scribbling down, okay, this is who this person is, but I don't know. You know, 10 issues from now, they could be forgotten. I just don't know.
Yeah, but there's standard storytelling techniques that sometimes give you clues on that.
Correct.
You know, if you're watching a primetime TV show and they bump into somebody at the you know, the coffee shop or whatever, they exchange words, but the other character's never named, they may not matter.
Exactly.
But if it's, you know, hey, so-and-so, how you doing? Maybe they matter. Maybe just for that issue or that episode, but maybe more. The fact that he habitually doesn't name some of these characters, I think, is part of what makes it a little hard to know who matters and who doesn't.
Yeah, and I would agree with you there, because that's the thing. Like, even those, the grave robbers, the blue guys,
mm-hmm.
I felt like they should be important, but I really don't know because of everything that's been tossed in here. I just don't know at this point.
Well, by issue 9 here, they're resurrecting the immortal.
Yeah, exactly.
And they do show up on and off later in the series, I believe.
Now, the one thing I did like about this 9th issue, you know, we got that little Star Trek intro and all that stuff, but it was kind of funny how they fast forward and like, we need to rebuild the Justice League, basically, and they're holding auditions. And I kind of like that.
It's funny because they're rebuilding the Justice League, but they do it in Legion of Superheroes style.
Oh, yeah.
Open casting call, essentially. Come in and show me your powers.
That was funny. I like that.
I liked the introduction of Monster Girl.
That's the one I like the most, because I'm literally looking at her right now and just, oh, you know, little girl type thing, too. She's going to beat the snot out of you.
Mm-hmm.
I really just... She's a character that I really liked. There's certain books that you read and you just kind of key in and you're like, this is a character for me. She's a character for me. I want to know more about her. I want to read more about her. Just like when I read Damien, you know? I'm like, Oh, I like this. I like this kid. I got to read more about him.
Mm-hmm. But some characters pop off the page more than others.
Yeah. And I think this is a winner right here. He picked a good one.
Yeah. Yeah. And she shows up more after this.
Oh, that makes me happy.
So she's not just a throwaway character.
Good. Because she's the best of the bunch, I think.
Now, in that next issue, we finally get the detective from issue 8 gets a name.
Yep.
The page where he's, like, spotlighting the reuse of multiple panels and stuff like that when Mark's at the comic shop, I'm like, not particularly funny, and definitely seemed to be an acknowledgement of what he'd done on issue 7.
Yeah. I was like, all right, so we're going to go there. All right, let's make this happen.
That, to me, was a little too metatextual and in a not-so-good way.
Yeah, I read that and I was like, har har. But yeah, exactly. It's lowbrow humor.
Now, when we get Immortal going after Omni-Man, and geez, I can see why he's carrying a grudge, on that TV footage, is that April O'Neil from the Turtles?
I think so.
Again, multiple references and such.
Very cool. Yeah.
So, and again, a subtle little nod. Either you get it and it's like, okay, that's a cool Easter egg, or you don't and you're none the wiser.
Yeah, all right. I didn't get that at first, but now that you say it, I'm like, oh, yeah, there we go. Very cool. But you see the fight with him in Omni-Man, and it's, once again, a brutal fight. And then just seeing Mark there, that is just a gut punch.
Yeah. The ending on this, when Omni-Man kills Immortal again, and decisively so,
yeah.
There was some gore there. And then add to that, you know, Mark finally, you know, 4 issues later or something, realizing, you know, what his dad has done.
Yeah, you see, like, literally, like, a shock come over the father's face, and then almost a softness come over him. Hey, son, we need to talk. And I'm just like, the creepiest thing as you're, you know, doused in gore.
Well, they're doing a, I believe, animated series on Invincible for Amazon, and I think J.K. Simmons is going to do the voice of Omni-Man.
Oh, okay, cool.
He's, of course, better known as J. Jonah Jameson on some of the Spider-Man films.
Yeah.
I think
he'll be good.
Also the lead in Counterpart.
Okay, cool.
Great actor.
Yeah. So I think he'll be a good voice actor.
I think
that'd be awesome.
And I'm curious how much of the story survives intact. In other words, I can't imagine Omni-Man not killing off the equivalent of Guardians of the Globe. I'm curious if they will be as blatantly a Justice League based characters or not. Probably. I don't see any reason to change it.
Yeah, and I'm curious how bloody it gets.
That, yeah, I'm curious what the rating is going to be for that show.
Because it would have to be an R rating with what we're seeing here. This is definitely not a PG-13 book, I would say.
No. Yeah, that was the whole takedown of Immortal again was much more graphic than I felt was needed. But again, trying to make a point of this isn't Superman.
Definitely not Superman. It's Superman, but almost a psychopathic Superman. Something's gone wrong.
Yeah.
And it's terrifying because what I mean by psychopath is he can go from that brutality to turning around and being like, oh, my dear son, we need to talk. And I'm just like, man, that is just so creepy. And you can just see, even though you can't see Mark's face, just his body language is like, what the heck is going on? Oh, well, my God.
And that's something where both Otley on the art and Kirkman on the writing set up the moment well. And even in static panels, you get that sense of that dawning realization for Mark.
Yeah. And even the body language of almost leaning back from his father is, I like that, how he had him lean back, like, don't come near me.
Well, and Kirkman knew that as much of a shock as the ending to Seven was going to be, this was really the major gut punch to the reader.
Yeah, this was the one, and this is us feeling it through a, imagine if it was your father and you saw this, like, just something so horrendous, you know, that this can't be my dad, you know, and I can't imagine it, you know, and so he's seeing this. Someone who's been very kind to him, this is something you would never expect to see.
Yeah.
It just rocks your world.
Well, and that's where I think 7 through 13 here are, in my mind, really paced as a trade paperback.
Very much.
Of you've got the setup of the Guardians of the Globe, here's kind of that middle turning point, and then you're going to get there at the end of not a sense of resolution, but the sense of, okay, let's move on to the next story, the next chapter of a story.
Yeah, exactly. And what's funny is, as we wrap up that 10th issue, we get into the 11th, it was kind of weird because, like, you almost see a retelling of the origin that we had before.
You very much see a retelling of it, and what's interesting is it's by a different artist.
Yeah, so that was kind of cool. It's a different artist, and it's a complete retelling. It's like, oh, that origin story I gave you before was a lie. Let me tell you the real deal.
I didn't go compare the pages between the two, but it's very much the same panels and layout, just, again, slightly different because of the different artist or whatever, and very much mirroring, we told you the fairy tale version, now we're going to tell you the grimmer version.
Yeah, you're a grown-up young man, now you've seen me eviscerate someone. So now you can deal with the truth, and the truth is that we are the, what is it, Viltrum?
The Viltrum, yeah.
And we are a basically an empire and a conquering race or society or whatever. And we enslave others.
Yeah, I mean, Omni-Man basically became a hero to save Earth for his empire.
Yeah.
It's like his planet. Get the hell off it, you know?
Mine. I'm claiming it. And just seeing, you know, and Mark's like, can't believe it, you know, just hearing that and basically saying, you know, like, you know, his mom and all the stuff you're seeing there and how that plays out just was gut wrenching.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, okay, they live for a long time. How spoilery are we getting? Can we get full spoilery?
They live for a really long time.
Yeah, they almost like forever, we'll pretend. So,
well, again, Superman, at times, they've established that's kind of his case, too.
Yeah, so they live forever. So here he is. He's had a child, and their genes are so pure that this child will basically be taken over and maybe even better than him with his pure genes to be something maybe even a little bit stronger. But he sees the mothers almost like cattle, which I was just shocked and wow, because you'd seen so much love at the beginning of this comic, you know, so much of like the daily little nuances and the kisses and the touches. And then you go to the something's wrong with you to the he's coming out and saying, she's just a thing. It's just cattle. It's something I do. We're here to conquer these people. And it's just to hear that come out of his mouth. Mark's probably just sick to his stomach.
So totally in shock, definitely. But there's also some scenes where I think set that up. So there are times where it's like, okay, you know, Omni-Man's been gone for, you know, a while and just walks in and it's no big deal. There's no, you know, emotional reunion at that point. And
yeah, that's true.
There's a lot of apathetic moments in that household.
That's true. Now that you say that, I remember that because I was kind of surprised when she just kind of gave a look when, you know, like something would happen, you know, oh, he's not there.
The wife is very unflappable, but in a very non-Lois Lane way.
Yeah.
Lois Lane has seen it all and can handle it all. Omni-Man's wife, has she gotten named, by the way?
I honestly don't know.
I don't remember
her name. Mom
yeah.
is what I call her. I call her Mom in my notes.
To me, she's almost like she's sedated.
Yeah. Going through the movements, going through the motions, and yeah. Now that you say it, and now that I'm looking back and I'm thinking back, you're right. It's almost like she's sedated and she's just going through it. And maybe he's had that real discussion with her, you know? Hey, I'm here. We're raising our son, you know? You're going to be a good mother to him, but you're nothing more than a vessel to me.
I don't think they had that discussion.
You don't? Okay.
But I think being married to Omni-Man or a Superman type could be more than some people could handle.
I think it'd be more than I could handle if my wife was becoming a Superwoman or Wonder Woman. I don't know if I could handle it. Maybe I could. I don't know until
well,
it happened.
Again, you watch, you know, these fights on TV, the guy vanishes for a while, that kind of a stuff. It is a lot to take.
You got to be a very strong person. And like you said, unflappable. That's mm-hmm. who she's been. And I don't know if I'd be that way. I think I'd be, I hate to say it, but I'd probably be too emotional to have that person as my spouse or my significant other.
Yeah, yeah. I think this issue really was a prolonged moment between the previous one and the next. Okay,
yeah.
You know, Mark's kind of gotten the knowledge that we've had for a good couple of issues. It's sinking in, they're having that discussion, but it really ends with those two just kind of, you know, squaring off of, this probably isn't going to go well for Mark.
Nope. And that whole next issue is a fight that the father at the beginning is holding his punches and mm-hmm. taking, you know, what Mark's given to him until he's done with Mark doing what he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, okay, son, you want to be a man? Let me hit you like a man.
Yeah, yeah.
Pretty much. I mean, those aren't the words, but those are the actions.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's like, you're not going to back down. I'm tired of this. You're misbehaving. You're going to get spanked.
And that's a spanking he gets.
Oh, yeah. And there's a ton of property damage in this issue.
Yeah. That was it's an issue-long fight. And reading this in single issues, it'd be weird to pick this up as a first issue. And that's where I go with most of the image writers today.
Mm-hmm.
They're really writing for the trade. They're not writing for the single issues. And that's how this is meant to be read, honestly.
Well, there's one thing to write for the series in terms of the never-ending saga that we used to get back in the 80s and whatnot. But this is very much chapters of a story.
Yeah.
And there are times where that monthly pacing didn't work out well. And there are other times where it's like, okay, I do need a little time to absorb this moment we just ended on.
Yeah. And I would say this fight, even though it's a fight book, this one, it felt very satisfying because there was some discussion that did happen in there. How it played out was just really good.
Mm-hmm.
And seeing Mark getting the short end of the stick there and how it ended, because I thought his dad was going to go too far. And his dad almost did go too far.
Yeah, but Mark seemed to really start to get through to his dad there at the end.
Yeah, that was kind of cool. He's like, when he's like literally just, you know, dad, and the father started to tremble with his fist.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of cool, the art, because you can see the little lines, like the Kirby lines, the trembling, and then you see him flying away, and then that last panel, that was really kind of touching.
Well, yeah, because there'd be that expectation of, okay, how is our title character Invincible going to, you know, save the day and overcome, you know, this physical battle and such. And then Kirkman flips it to where it's a very emotional moment there at the end, and that's what's the turning point.
Yeah, you hate the guy, but then you feel a little bit bad, and you see he has emotion. It's very weird. So the characters started to feel real for me, and they didn't feel one-dimensional at this mm-hmm. point, because I felt like the dad was one-dimensional up until now. And I don't mean that as one-dimensional. He was living a dual life. I thought he was just a psychopath. But when I saw that panel, I was like, the dad has real emotion and he cares. He's not just an animal. He's not just this Viltrium soldier that's going to conquer and he cares about nothing other than the Empire.
Well, it's taken until these issues that we're discussing for the character of Omni-Man to be more than just the placeholder sitcom father.
Yeah.
You know, we're not doing it for laughs, we're doing it for superheroing instead. But until we see him, you know, killing off the Guardians of the Globe, explaining to Mark why he's really on Earth, we hadn't gotten enough to know about it.
Exactly.
You know?
And now you feel like you know him and you don't like him, but you realize he's a person.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very weird, isn't it?
It is. And what little
but good.
It's good, but what little we'd gotten to know about Omni-Man was the misinformation he'd given us, you know, issue, what, 4 or 5 or something.
Yeah.
You know, the nice, peaceful origin story.
Yeah. So I thought this was a really good issue.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like the series is getting better and better with every issue as it goes at this point.
Absolutely. And I think that there is an aspect of, you know, as much as it felt like they were almost playing for time in the first 6, in these 7, I mean, there's a couple of really powerful issues that are, wow, you know, I got to see what happens next. You know, certainly issue 7, I think, with issue 10, certainly, you know, here with 12 and stuff of, okay, where do they go from here?
Exactly. Yeah, I agree. Know.
And then when we get to number 13 there, I mean, there's a good 3 pages before the letterer shows up for work.
Yeah, it was. I thought it was kind of funny when you see Mark at the beginning of 13,
mm-hmm.
and it's like, I guess these people came to the top of this mountaintop, but I guess these are like the equivalent of the Justice League, maybe.
I was thinking S.H.I.E.L.D., but yeah.
S.H.I.E.L.D., okay, yeah. They're human helpers, so these are the S.H.I.E.L.D. equivalent, but yeah, they're having to go and pick him up because he's not looking too good. And seeing Mom, she knows who's fighting. And S.H.I.E.L.D. is there in the house, so you're not seeing anything, but the art is telling the story, and I thought Ryan Ottley did a really good job at this.
Mm-hmm.
Just seeing all the friends, the reactions, everyone's watching, the hospital scene.
It covered a lot of ground in those pages.
Yeah, it's like 3 pages, but it's telling a lot of story. I was like, man, this is cool.
Mm-hmm. It moved the story forward, 2 weeks or something, without really glossing over much. We get the things we need. And then we finally get a name for that government guy from issue number 9 that Donald worked for,
yep.
Cecil Stedman, and learn that he'd faked the death of Nolan Grayson, Omni-Man's alter ego and such, and essentially, you know, hires Mark on as a quote-unquote official superhero.
Yeah, we need you. Yeah. They basically have lost Omni-Man at this point. He is gone rogue, and this kid is the only one who may potentially be at that level.
Mm-hmm.
They need him.
And even if he's not, he's still the son of, and therefore might be, you know, something you could use to slow him down.
You know, maybe they can manipulate him or stop him or something.
Something.
Or hold a bargaining chip.
Now, one of the things I will give Kirkman and Ottley credit for is when we go into space,
mm-hmm.
there's that guy in that plane.
Okay.
That's the guy the Immortal threw into space back in issue 7.
Yeah.
So there is an aspect of some of the stuff, even minor stuff, has, I don't say ramifications, but is remembered by the creators.
Yeah, now that you say that, I remember that. I'm like, oh, yeah, yeah.
And so, if you read it and you miss it, you're not losing out on the story. But if you catch it, oh, that's cool.
That's true. Now I remember. I'm like, oh, yeah, I remember.
I did think it was hilarious that Alan the Alien was there to warn Mark about the Viltrumite on Earth. And he's like, yeah, I know about that.
Yeah, that's my bad. Essentially, he's a Viltrumite too. Half, but basically maybe more powerful one day.
Now, I thought it was interesting that Alan kind of, you know, his dialogue there is establishing the coalition of planets they've marked on Earth because, well, it's off limits because there's a Viltrumite and we're just not going to mess with that. But it set up that the coalition of planets is at odds with the Viltrumite Empire and that sooner or later there's going to be a reckoning.
That was super cool because now I'm feeling, okay, now we're building a big narrative. And Alan the Alien is going to, and Invincible, of course, likes this guy. They're mm-hmm. friends at this point. And he's seeing his dad as an evil character. Is my dad can't be trusted anymore? Is there's a partnership being built here? Maybe a Viltrumite that's going to face his people. Mm-hmm. And just the story and the tapestry has just gotten so much larger as they're looking on that last panel from the moon, just looking at the Earth. You're realizing this is going to be a galactic story, and this is going to be so cool.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm excited. I want to read the rest.
Yeah, I was curious what you were thinking of the series now, because, I mean, clearly a ton happens in these issues.
So much better, because, like, when the story, when we were first reading it, let's say it's C+, B-, to now it's moved into that A category where it's, like, almost that must read. Mm-hmm. I got to read this. This is a cool story. And so it's kind of funny, because I feel like comics today wouldn't be given this much time to breathe to get to this point. Maybe they make it there, maybe they don't. But I think it's kind of cool that he was given, you know, he didn't really hook me into like the 7th issue. And then by the end of this, he's really, really hooked me. And, you know, there's a lot of stories that start up today that may have a good idea and are inkling of a good idea. But if they don't hook you at the beginning, you're not going to be there for the 13th issue.
Well, but I think that's also one of the signs of how Kirkman has changed over time. For both this and Walking Dead, I say you got to give it almost that first 12 issues to really get solidly hooked on the title.
Yeah.
And young Kirkman was willing to do that and had apparently the means to keep the title around long enough to do that. Whereas I think the older Kirkman has realized you got to hit hard on that first issue.
You have to. Exactly. Yeah, and I can see the difference, and I'm sure you can see the difference. We're both reading Firepower right now.
Mm-hmm.
There were things in Firepower in that first issue that I was, okay, this is riveting. I got to read the next issue, which was missing in this. And I think that's because he's grown and he's realized that the market today, you can't give it a slow breathe. You have to be able to have some kind of entertainment value there that keeps the people hooked from the jump to keep them going.
I'm going to disagree with you on that.
Really?
I think Kirkman with Firepower did almost
the trade,
the exact same thing that he's doing here, but the first 6 issues were the trade. Exactly.
That's true. I forgot about the trade. Ah, I lied. I forgot. That trade really built that story momentum, didn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for reminding me, because that's literally how bad my memory is. I forgot that I read the trade because I read it. And I'm thinking the first issue I was hooked, but it was the first trade I was hooked. The whole backstory and the story of Kunlun or whatever it was called in that story, building that backstory has really hooked me. And now I'm like going from issue to issue, but that's true.
Well, and I think these 7 issues would not have worked as well for us without the first 6.
Exactly. I agree. So I'm happy. I'm really, really happy that we read this, and I'm so happy that you told me to read through issue 13.
Mm-hmm.
Does it get better from here? Just better and better?
I would say so. I think there's a couple of places where, like with any series, it's not always getting better and better. I don't think it ever got bad. There were a couple of particular issues, like when he did kind of a event comic inside of a single issue.
Yeah.
And it was a long issue. I think it was issue 60 or something. I mean, he did some great stuff.
Yeah.
There were a few places where I thought he made a mistake or two. You know, there was a point around, I want to say, issue 111, where he's like, well, I'm going to kind of restart the series or whatever, bold new direction. I'm like, You know?
You know what? I remember that.
Overall, though, this series, I think, was really good. And, I mean, if you think about it in terms of, and it's been a few years since the title ended, but in terms of modern comics, this is one of the longer-running superhero narratives that's happened. Yeah. And certainly one of the longest stable creative teams for such a thing.
Okay. Because Brian Otley was there until the end. And then that's when he went to Marvel, correct?
I believe so, yeah.
Now, question for you. Did it feel like, okay, with Walking Dead, I felt like the ending was good. It was satisfying. You know, I realized and what happened. It kind of gave some closure to the story. Do you like the way this story ended? Did it end well?
It had a sense of closure. I'm trying to think of exactly what I thought of it at the time. It's been a little while. Overall, I think I liked it.
Okay.
And I think it didn't leave things hanging.
Okay.
So I think in terms of, you know, are you going to read, you know, 100-some-odd issues and get to a, they end here? What are they, you know? No, you're going to get to an end and say, okay, they closed it off and ended it gracefully.
Oh, okay. Cool. All right. Now, I remember, okay, and I'm testing your memory here, and I hate to do this to you, but sometimes it's fun.
No, you love to do it. I just hate to. Somebody maybe, you know, hey, I just listened to that episode, John, and you said this. It's like, well, maybe I did. I don't remember.
You remember in issue 67 of this when Bob, no, I'm not going to test your knowledge, but okay, I remember the reboot thing, and if I'm not mistaken, I think I bought it because they said, oh, a jumping on point, something, and I read it, and I was like, I don't think I continue reading it. But you said you felt like it was a miss. Did they take the book in a completely new direction and you didn't like what they did there? I mean, you don't have to spoil it. But
they made a decisive change that okay. I'm pretty sure they totally backpedaled on later. And it was an interesting idea.
Okay.
But not what I think most of the rest of the readers really responded well to.
All right. See, after doing this, I feel like, okay, we have a book club, you know, on the mm-hmm. Slack channel. For people who are not members of the Slack channel, join the Slack channel because there's a lot of people there chatting. But also, we have a book club, which we're not doing it all the time. We take pauses for, like, the holidays and stuff like that. But this is something I could see us doing in, like, a book club where we spread it out over, you know, once every couple weeks we meet. We do, like, maybe the first couple trades of Invincible until we get to the end.
Mm-hmm.
This one looks like it would be fun, you know, and probably a lot of people haven't read this. When I say a lot of people haven't, not as many people who've read Walking Dead. This wasn't the most popular one. Walking Dead was his most popular writing. So I think there's a large group of people that may enjoy this who never read it. I'm one of them.
I agree with that entirely. Word of advice, if you do that, don't just say, hey, we'll do 6 issues at a chunk, because you may hit one or two that are really long.
Okay.
But yeah, I think it's a series well worth reading. Like any, it has some ups and downs. Overall, I think it was really good. Kirkman does get better and better as a writer over time. And this is a world in which, you know, pretty much anything can happen.
Yeah. Now, does the cast of characters get ridiculously large? Is it like the Legion?
No.
Something like that.
More characters obviously get introduced over time, but other characters become irrelevant over time.
Okay, that I can deal with. The Legion, it was kind of overwhelming for me. I was just like, this is too much. I don't know who anyone is.
Well, if you're talking the current Bendis Legion, well, yeah, it's kind of ridiculous because he's trying to tell a story with all of them all at once. You know, and he's bouncing between like 12 different plot lines, it feels like.
Yeah, that's what I've been reading. I was like, okay, I can't do this anymore.
If you go back to the Legion of Superheroes of like the 70s or 80s or whatnot, they tended to usually have issues that focused on, you know, 5 or 6 of them, and maybe they'd rotate over issues as to which 5 or 6.
So okay.
Over the course of a year, you'd get to know all of them, but not all at once.
Okay, all right.
It's like starting a new job. You don't walk in the door and suddenly have to know everybody, everything about everybody.
You just know your little group of cubicle buddies or the team that you're with. That's
exactly.
It.
And then as you encounter other people, you get to know them. And you know, you be there long enough and you know hundreds of people at a company if it's big enough.
And I think that makes it digestible. And I'm so I guess that's one of my problems with Bendis. I know we're getting completely off topic, but Bendis, he turned me off Legion. I'd never read Legion, but I went in there and I'm seeing 5,000 characters and they're always new and always changing. I was like, I can't do this anymore. It was cool with the Aquaman Trident thing, and I was like, mm-hmm. okay, it's just too many people. I'm getting confused. I'm out.
Now, I got onto the Legion back in, late 70s, early 80s type stuff. Grell was doing some of the art. I forget who was doing some of the writing and stuff. And it was, here's the roll call for the issue. Here's the half dozen or so.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, okay, now I kind of know who, Timberwolf is or who, Cosmic Boy is or whatever. And then again, next issue, I get a couple of different ones, maybe a few of the same, and you get to know them. And the funny thing is, I don't recall Invincible ever doing any kind of, and they probably didn't, I've just forgotten it, riff on the Legion. But if you think about it, Mark is essentially Superboy.
Yeah.
The Legion came out of Superboy.
Very true.
Yep. So I hope that at some point Kirkman comes back and revisits the property in some way, shape, or form. Whether it's more, story set in the timeline of the series or after it, or he could even do, it'd be a lot of fun if he were to do a Legion of Superheroes riff inspired by, Invincible.
Yeah. You know what I'm really waiting to see? And I don't mean this to sound morbid, but it may sound a bit morbid, but eventually, like a Todd McFarlane or Eric Larson, or a whoever, any of those Image founders or Robert Kirkman, they're going to pass away one day. What happens to these properties at that point? I don't know. Does Spawn cease to exist, or does the Spawn property continue to exist and it's sold, whoever his family members inherit it, they sell it to Marvel or they hire other creators to create the book. I'm just waiting to see how these characters progress after the creator is done. And I hate this. I don't mean it sound like that, but I wonder if they have an end plan for this. Like, what's going to happen to this property if something happened to McFarlane or to Kirkman? I imagine his wife doesn't want to create it. Maybe she does. I don't know. But is there a plan in place to sell this character off and sell the rights? I don't know.
For some of them, like McFarlane stuff, I think it's Todd McFarlane Enterprises that actually owns the stuff. So that's a corporate entity of some sort.
Yeah.
That could easily continue without him. Just as Aspen kind of continued on without Michael Turner.
Very true. So I'm assuming some CEO will take over and just continue to run the company and do its thing.
Certainly a possibility. Now, with Kirkman's stuff, you've got Skybound. Yep. I don't know what it owns versus what is owned by Kirkman and the artists and all that kind of stuff. So I don't know how much of Kirkman's library could continue in the event of his death, or his turning into a zombie and living forever, whichever, going with the Walking Dead riff. I don't know. But that is one of the differences between creator-owned stuff and corporate-owned stuff, is there comes a point with the creator-owned that either their estate continues with it, or the property just languishes.
Yeah. And that's what I'm waiting to see. And like I said, I don't mean it to sound morbid. It's not because I'm trying to see an endgame, but I know something's going to happen eventually. And I just want to see if the properties continue or if they're just auctioned off to the highest bidder. I just don't know. I'm assuming if I spent my entire life creating Invincible and Walking Dead and this and that, maybe I'd want to set it up for my family for generations, or maybe I would have an end game where I'd say, hey, upon my demise, almost like the corporations will have these buy-sell agreements. I'll sell my corporation to you, Todd McFarlane, all these properties, or mm-hmm. or to you, Marvel Comics. And I think the value of my stuff, and they come to an agreement, is $50 million. And they set up a life insurance contract. So upon the demise, Marvel Comics kicks out $50 million to his family, and they just take over the properties. And so I'm sure there must be planning behind the scenes. And I imagine they'll all play out differently. But, those days are coming. They're a ways off because most of these creators are pretty young. But, who knows? Stuff happens.
Well, but the other question is, how much value is there in some of these properties without their original creator?
That's the question. I don't know. Very true. Because the genius is Robert Kirkman. I wouldn't say it's zombies because there's been zombies done before. The genius was Robert Kirkman.
I'll be honest, there's a couple of comic properties out there that if I was given the chance to purchase the rights outright, for an affordable amount and, reprint the past material, whatever, I would certainly consider it for a few things.
Yeah.
Now, whether I could then take it and turn them into something viable or not, don't know.
something completely different.
Well, it's not even something completely different. It's, can I either write a story well enough or hire people who could write a story well enough of an existing property that was kind of, you know, somebody else's creation,
yeah,
that languished enough that it's now in a viable state for an affordable amount.
Yeah. It, you know, we are completely off the rails here, but it reminds me, I can't remember who it was. I think it was, what's the committee that does Witchblade?
Top Cow.
Top Cow did, and if I'm not mistaken, they did something like a Battlestar Galactica. They licensed the comics a long time ago. And I remember I was reading about this, and I think it was from the guy who does Swing, Hawkins, Matt Hawkins. And he's like, hey, we were doing a great job. We were making tons of money for them, and we made money for ourselves. And it came up for the relicensing of the book. And he's like, you know, we kind of reinvigorated the property, and they were doing some stuff with the TV show. And so now, let's say the license was X thousands of dollars, and they went up 10 to 20 fold because they say now the property's worth this so much.
Yep.
Because you've done a great job with it. And he's like, that was a real kick in the gut. So go find somewhere else to do this stuff.
Well, I think that's one of the many reasons people like Robert Kirkman do creator-owned books like Invincible, is why spend the time and money building up somebody else's property?
Yeah, just for them to yank it out from underneath you, a la Dark Horse.
You know, if you're going to spend that time and effort, do it on something you own. And there's a lot to be said for that.
Yeah.
It's kind of the creative equivalent of, you know, buying instead of renting.
Very true. You know, yeah, you build up your equity. You're always better off owning in the long run, usually.
there's some costs to it, but I think there's definitely some benefits to be had because, again, Invincible is going to be coming as a Amazon animated series, and Kirkman's going to benefit from that, not, you know, some corporate overlord. Just
Very
as
true.
Kirkman has benefited from, you know, the 10 years worth of AMC's Walking Dead show, the Fear of the Walking Dead, and whatever the other spinoff was.
Yeah, and whatever that one was, yeah.
He's made some money because he owned the property.
Very smart. Yeah.
And he also took the risk, though, of sinking his own money in for paying for the Image Eye to get these early issues of Walking Dead and Invincible out, with, at that point, no sign it would become what it became.
Yeah. And it's and almost funny, you know, Black and White was done because he couldn't afford a color artist when he first came out with Walking Dead, and it didn't almost make it through. And when he came out of the hole and it started climbing up from the bottom, you know, sales ranks all the way up, now he's redoing it in color, maybe the way he really wished he could have done it from the beginning. Who knows?
There was actually some color of Walking Dead at one point. I think it was issue 75. It was a backup feature, I think.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. I remember, I think heard somewhere he said, I didn't go with color because it would cost too much.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And
that's just kind of funny looking back that he's like, now I have so much money and the property's so popular, I can reprint the same material with color, and this is what I would have done.
Well, I mean, think about it. At the time, he was also doing Invincible here.
Yeah.
So he was bankrolling these two titles. I forget what else he may have had going on at the same time.
Might have had Battle Pope. Who knows what he was doing at the time.
That or Brit or something like that. But, I mean, he was entrepreneurial and investing in his future, and it paid off.
Yeah. I'm happy to see people be successful in life, you know, and hear their stories.
Yeah.
So, hey, man, this was a good read, and I'm glad we got to read it together. And if you want to revisit it again in the future, I'm completely up to it. So
sure,
just keep me posted on how you feel.
Definitely keep that in mind. I enjoy the series. Would be fine to continue reading it and such. I mean, this is Kirkman at his earlier stage as a writer, so it's not perfect, but it is an interesting and certainly in these issues a very eventful read. And anyone who hasn't checked it out, I think should.
I agree. And I'm going to recommend it to the book club.
Cool. Cool. Now, I do want to give a quick final reminder for the yearly comics spotlight.
Oh, yeah.
This episode is getting released on Monday, January 4th, and the deadline for the yearly comics spotlight is Wednesday morning, January 6th. So you've got less than like 48 hours, depending how quickly you downloaded this episode. The instructions are go to the forum, go to the thread on the website there. NixPix has already done this. He's copied the thing, put it into his own post on the thread, and started to fill some stuff out with the I'm going to come back later and fill the rest out, which is like, hey, that's cool. I appreciated him going so quick and starting that because it allowed me to test my process of, you know, pulling the information for us to use for recording and getting it into a nice usable manner. But so far we've got a partial entry, and you know, as we're recording this, it's still a few weeks off. As you guys are listening to this, it's, you know, imminent deadline. So hopefully we'll have a lot of picks and input and stuff. I'm curious what people think of what did come out in 2020, and to a degree, what didn't come out in 2020.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. I'm interested to see what other people liked with such a weird year and the shipping as what it was. Just seeing what everyone thought was really cool.
Yeah, definitely. I think 2020 was highly unusual in many regards. There was some good stuff that came out. Some other stuff, it didn't get out because pandemic, etc. But yeah, I definitely would love to hear what all the listeners are thinking, and encourage them to go to the comicbookpage.com website. There's a link to the forum on the front page. Go there, look for the yearly comic spotlight for 2020, and again, participate. Really, that's a lot of what keeps this podcast going, is listener participation.
Hey, and by the way, you didn't put a link on the Slack channel, did you?
I did.
Oh, you did? Okay, my bad. I haven't been able to use Slack a lot today.
Feel free to keep reposting it. I put it up about a week or so ago.
Okay, I'm going to keep posting it on the Slack channel and like messaging everyone, just spamming everyone. Hey, put in your votes. See if we can get a lot of people to vote.
It'd be great. I mean, sometimes we've gotten a handful of submissions. Other times we've gotten a dozen or so. But the more we get, one, the longer the episode will be, which is pros and cons. But the more input we get, the better diversity of opinions and stuff. And really, I've picked up a lot of titles over the years because enough people mentioned, oh yeah, this is a great title on the Yearly Comic Spotlight. I'm like, I'm unfamiliar with it. I have not read it, and wound up loving some of those things.
Yeah. And I literally just went to the website while you were talking. And yeah, we already have Nick's picks. He put in some picks for there. So kind of cool. I'm going to post it again just for the heck of it.
And again, you can do what Nick did of start your entry now and then just continue editing it as, oh yeah, I should do this for that one.
Yeah, that's a smart thing to do. And I'll save mine. I won't put mine there because we're going to do a recording.
Yeah, exactly. I'll be honest. I'm probably going to wait until, about the time this episode goes up and figure out my picks for the year. I always have a hard time filling these things out myself.
Me too. I really do.
It's hard for me to remember everything I've read during the year, what I thought of it, and even with my notes and stuff. And I actually started looking at my notes for the year and noticed one or two trends that I found interesting already. But I'll save that, hopefully, for that episode.
All right. Well, I'm interested to see or hear about your trends.
Yeah. Anything else?
Nah, that does it for me.
Cool.
The January 2021 previews came out on December 30th, and the deadline for preview spotlight number 158 is the morning of Saturday, January 9th, 2020. Recording clips for the preview spotlight episodes is easy, and we've got an open submission policy for these episodes. Please send in clips to support the comics you love as often as you can. If you'd like to get email reminders for the preview spotlight episodes, you can join the emailing list on the main page of the comicbookpage.com website. And a quick reminder that we've also got the recommendation roundtable episodes going. The point of those episodes is to help people find other ways to spend their time. So send in pics of comic books, either older ones, back issues, trades, whatever, novels, television shows, movies, video games, if there's a board game you think people might really enjoy or something. Let's get that out there. We've got a lot of ways we can spend our time in helping people find things that they might be interested in. It's just a great thing to do. I've gotten a lot of clips from Billy Hogan. I want to thank him for that. It reminded me that I should really go reread Astro City and put a few other things kind of back on my radar, including a couple of novels he recommended. I've added those to my reading list. We'll see when I get to them. But we've got no deadline for these episodes. The way these episodes work is you send in one clip per pick, and that could be a particular book or video game or TV show, or it could be a series of books, anything that's kind of a unified thing. And when I get enough of those clips, I'll string them together, I'll kick out an episode. So that means if I get tons of clips, like when Billy sent me an hour and 45 minutes of some great clips, that was enough for me to get two episodes put together, about an hour for one and about 45 minutes or so for the other. So that's what episodes 2 and 3 are. But if I don't get clips, it may be a while before that next episode comes out. And the reason I'm doing this is there are a lot of things hitting like the streaming services and stuff like that on not really a set cadence like we've got for the preview spotlight. So if you wake up one morning and say, you know what, there's a bunch of stuff I think people might enjoy, spend a few minutes, send in the clips, they get in the queue. And if it's another few months before you do the next one, that's great. But hopefully we have enough people sending in clips on a regular enough basis that we can be putting one of these episodes out every month, every other month, or something like that. So once again, the point here is just to recommend older comic books, novels, television shows, movies, video games, or anything else that doesn't really fit the format of the preview spotlight, but do you really want to kind of share your love of and encourage other people to check out. So once again, there's no deadline on those recommendation roundtable clips. It's an open invitation for everybody at all times. So please send in clips when you've got something you're thinking about and share the love.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.